Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Good afternoon, and welcome. In less than a week, it will be Valentine's Day. So I hope you have cards, flowers, and candy ready for that Valentine of yours. Here are several Valentine stories from the Good Old Days magazine. This first one is entitled Seed Catalog Dreams. This delivery was better than any Valentine. This was sent in by Ramona Scarborough. In the 1950s, Vancouver, Washington, the town where I grew up, had dark, dreary, extremely rainy Februarys. But that month, I would hurry home from school to check the mailbox. On weekends, I would open an umbrella and sprint out to meet the mailman. "Waiting for a letter from your sweetheart?" he teased. "I don't have a sweetheart," I said. "So what are you anticipating, a big check?" "Nope, the Burpee Seed Catalog." That catalog was better to me than Valentine's Day cards. When it finally arrived, I slowly turned the brightly colored pages. Looking at the pictures of scarlet poppies and variegated pink peonies, I never thought about the weeding I would have to do May through August. Sometimes Mama would join me. We would sit side by side at the big dinner table, enjoying the creative descriptions. Peering through her bifocals, she would read aloud, "Breathtaking orange blooms, ideal for bouquets, loves full sun. What do you think?" She would circle the flower seeds and bulbs she wanted with a black marker. "I think I'll put black-eyed Susans by the fence and some of this blue verbena below them in the flower bed." The previous year, she had ordered pot of gold coneflowers. The profusion of yellow color had spilled over the sides of cement planters on both sides of our front walk. I had lain on the sidewalk between them last summer and watched butterflies use the flowers for landing pads and then flutter away above me. After dinner, when Dad got home from work, he would get out a big sheet of graph paper and the garden plan from last year. The same vegetables never went in the spot they had occupied the year before. Then he would look at the offerings in the seed catalog, check the prices, and begin selecting which ones we would buy. "Don't forget these new hybrids," he'd say, flipping past them. "No flavor. Give me Blue Lake string beans and golden bantam sweet corn any day." When the large garden space was again laid out on paper, I wriggled in my seat, waiting to share my big decision. "Okay," Dad would say, "what's it going to be this year?" Each year, I was allotted a small space to grow whatever I wanted. This privilege came with the obligation of its sole care, watering, weeding, and feeding. No ordinary veggies for me. I had chosen Indian corn one year, which now had a place of honor in a fancy bowl on a shelf. I chose purple carrots another year, which looked mighty odd after they were cooked. After reading the Bible account of Jonah, I wanted a bottle gourd plant. I also liked its foreign-sounding proper name from the catalog, calabash. But one year, my dad tried to dissuade me from my choice. "But I love watermelon," I said. "It's my favorite." He shook his head. "They don't do well in Washington. Not a long enough growing season. Not enough sun." But my mouth was already watering, thinking of pressing the red, frothy pieces up against the roof of my mouth and letting the juices flow out over my tongue. Also, I was not censored for not being ladylike when I spit out the seeds, because, as Mama said, who knows what they might do to your insides? When Dad saw I was not going to change my mind, he said, "Okay, suit yourself." Burpee's order blank was filled out and stuck in the envelope. I carried it to the mailbox. I smiled as I pictured my watermelon plant pushing its roots deep into the rich compost-fortified soil and its green tendrils stretching and unfurling. The golden flowers would magically turn into green striped thumpers that would make a satisfying crack when opened. In a couple of weeks, I was again racing to the mailbox to see if we had received our bounty. February was not so bad when the catalog created garden fever. That month and into March, the garden was soaking up rain and nitrogen from the lotus Dad had planted at the end of the growing season. In between showers in April, we turned the compost pile and shook it through the wire in the bottom of the tray he'd made. I was always amazed at how table scraps, lawn clippings, and help from wiggly worms made such fine, non-smelly fertilizer. Dad turned the lotus plants under, added compost, and rototilled the soil. Now the garden stood patiently waiting for early June planting. Mama let me put my watermelon seeds on the windowsill to germinate because Dad said the ground was not warm enough yet. I had thrust our garden thermometer 3 inches into the ground and sighed. Nope, not ready yet. I danced around when the first baby sprout appeared in the window pot and when the ground finally was ready to snuggle around my small plants. As the fledgling vegetation began to shoot up out of the hill and then spread out, I watered it religiously. School was out, and after my chores, I played outside with my friends, but I did not neglect my plants. When the first round balls began developing, I even brought kids by to show off my project. Dad was right. Washington does not normally have hot summers. But that particular year, I remember sitting in the shade on our patio, drinking lemonade, and reading books during the hot, humid afternoons. In August, we sat down at the patio picnic table. We ate Mama's fried chicken, potato salad, baked beans, and sweet, succulent watermelon. My watermelon. This small victory and the seed catalog, which banished the depressing gray days of February, are some of my special memories of childhood. This was Seed Catalog Dreams by Ramona Scarborough. This next story is a more traditional Valentine's Day story. It's entitled A Celebration in Room 10. It was up to her to save the day. This was sent in by Marilyn Ludwig. The third graders of Room 10 loved games and elections and cupcakes and cookies, but they did not love Valentine's Day. The boys especially were not fans. Back in 1970 in North Riverside, Illinois, giving a Valentine to each member of the class was mandatory. As the young teacher of this opinionated bunch, it was my job to get them on board well before room mothers arrived with pink and white frosted cupcakes and red Kool-Aid. "So, Valentine's Day is coming," I reminded the class, ignoring the boys' anguished groans. "I thought you might want to have an election about it." "You mean we can vote to skip it?" Joe blurted out without bothering to raise his hand. Many applauded. "Well, maybe, if you also want to skip the cupcakes and cookies your moms have been baking for days," that stopped them. Their moms would not be pleased. Besides, everyone wanted the goodies, a plus for any school day. Ever polite Eddie raised his hand. Can we vote not to give Valentines? But we already made the mailbox, Kathy and a few other girls whined, pointing to a large box with a wide slot in the top. Kathy and crew had given up several recesses to decorate it with colorful crepe paper and doilies. We must have Valentines.
Then let's not give them to everyone. It was Harry's suggestion, but the whole class agreed.
I understood, having once felt the same, but I also remembered being the new kid, hurt that I had received only a few.
No, Harry, I shook my head. School rules.
But that doesn't mean the Valentines have to be romantic.
Giggling followed, of course. Romantic, another word to avoid using in room 10.
Come on, class, you know what I mean. Valentines don't have to be mushy. They can be funny or even scary. I've brought lots of supplies for you to make your own. I determined to glance at each Valentine submitted just in case one of my little darlings decided to hurt the feelings of another darling.
You wouldn't have to sign your name. You could use a secret code.
Code? They perked up. That sounded exciting.
I'll show you how.
They were young enough to find substituting numbers for letters of the alphabet terribly clever. Judy frantically waved her hand.
You said an election. What would we be voting for?
Or against, Harry added.
We would elect our own king and queen of hearts, I said. You would pick the girl and boy in our class with the biggest hearts. Not necessarily the most popular, but the kindest. Your king and queen would be nice. They would want everyone to receive Valentines.
Would they wear crowns?
Of course, I said.
What would they get to do?
They would pass out the Valentines, help the room mothers with refreshments, and lead you in your favorite games.
Like 7-Up and Hit the Stick and Huckle Buckle Beanstalk?
Absolutely. They looked at one another and nodded. Several days before the big day, ballots were distributed. The spelling was curious and the handwriting problematic, but our winners were clear. Lori was the Queen of Hearts and Gary was King.
I'm always impressed by how honest children can be.
No, Lori and Gary weren't the most popular. That honor belonged to Sherry and Don. But they were certainly the kindest. When Room 10's Valentine's Day arrived, our royal couple conducted the party with the dignity the occasion warranted. At 3:15, box of leftover cookies in hand, I walked home, relieved. I had saved Room 10's Valentine's Day. But I couldn't help wondering what my class's next challenge would be. This was A Celebration in Room 10 by Marilyn Ludwig. This next item is from the Bits and Pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine, and it's not necessarily about Valentine's Day. But it is about a Valentine. This story is entitled Dreamboat, sent in by Judy Robertson. I grew up in a small town in Virginia, and I guess I was a typical teenager growing up in the 1960s. I loved rock and roll music, teen magazines, makeup, and really cute boys. One summer day, while running errands with my mom, my life changed when I saw a cute blonde boy drive by in a dark green 57 Chevy. He was a dreamboat, and I couldn't get him out of my mind. I kept seeing him from a distance,
and I hoped that one day I would get to meet him. My girlfriend lived across the street from the small grocery store where he worked, and we tried to watch him as he worked while we hid behind displays in the store. I guess he saw us, or someone told him I was asking questions about him, because he showed up in the parking lot at my school one afternoon. My mom was there to pick me up in our old beat-up 53 Chevy, so I was embarrassed and hid behind people until I could jump into our back seat. Then I told my mom to hurry up and drive away. As she drove off, I peeked out the window long enough to see one of my girlfriends talking to him. Oh, great, I thought. I'll never meet him now. But the good Lord smiled on me. The next Sunday afternoon, he pulled up in front of my house and asked if I could go for a ride with him. My mom said yes, and the rest is history, as they say. Here I am almost 53 years later, still with that dreamboat, and I love him more every day. This was Dreamboat by Judy W. Robertson. This next story is entitled Unlucky in Love. They were really trying to obey the rules, honest. This story was written and sent in by Lois Pritzloff. You are never to sit in a parked car with a boy. Never, ever, not under any circumstances. Mother admonished me. Do you understand me? I replied by nodding my head. It was 1954 in Illinois, and I was just 16 years old. At last, Mother, who was the disciplinarian in the family, was going to allow me to date. That was the gist of the conversation between mother and daughter. The words were suitable for a young lady who was about to embark on her first date. I was always careful to follow mother's guidance. But that was only the start of mother's rules. For example, my date was to come in so that mother and dad could meet him. This meant that he was invited to sit as mother grilled him, making him uncomfortable and me embarrassed. Then mother, who called the theater and knew when the movie ended, and who also knew how long it would take to get home, set a definite curfew. I was also commanded to come in immediately upon arriving home. This last rule was important, as it brings me to the night in question. My date and I had just returned to my house after seeing a movie. I think we might have seen Gene Kelly and Van Johnson in Brigadoon as it came out in 1954. We pulled up in front of our garage, which was detached from the house. A screened-in porch stuck out from the front of our home, several feet from the driveway where we sat. As we came to a stop, I looked out the window. And there it was, sure enough, a very large black and white skunk. It walked slowly with its head held high, as if to tell us, "This is my territory." Needless to say, we were not about to leave the safety of the car. About 5 minutes passed before the inevitable happened. Mother discovered that we were sitting in the car and we were not coming in. She was standing at the door of the screened-in porch. She began what can only be described, looking back, as quite the performance. At the time, it was downright scary. First, she just stood there and stared. She was probably making sure it was really her little girl sitting in the car with, gasp, a boy. Next, she put her hands on her hips as if to say, "I am really, really serious." Finally, she started turning the porch light on and off, on and off. By now, my date was slinking down in the seat, hoping to disappear. At last,
after what was probably the longest 5 minutes in human history, we decided to see if the skunk was gone. Carefully, we got out of the car and peered between the house and garage. Phew! No skunk appeared. As we walked toward the house, my date's face turned very red. Soon Dad joined Mother. Now my date was really feeling intimidated. Once Mother and Dad heard what had happened, though, a laugh was shared by all. Besides, there was a faint odor in the air. I'm just glad it wasn't coming from us. This was Unlucky in Love by Lois Pritzlaff. This next story is entitled A Forgettable First Date. His stomach, his voice, and even his feet were uncooperative. This story was sent in by Stephen C. Olson. The date, November 12th, is one I will never forget. It was a Thursday. My best friend and I had decided to double date the following night. The two of us were equally nervous, not because we were undecided about who we wanted to ask, but because we had discovered there was an opposite sex only a year before, and that just wasn't enough time to adjust to this new reality. Although girls are generally referred to as the gentle sex, I would have preferred to face an entire pride of lions than one of those gentle creatures back then. Although I always talked to Judy just before I went to English class at our Jamestown, New York High School, today my stomach did flip-flops as I saw her approaching. I tried my best not to let my nervousness show. I had pictured in my mind exactly how I would casually bring up the topic of the senior class play. And then, in the very cool and collected style I had seen on many television shows, I would ask her if she would like to go see it with me. Well, somewhere along the way, my mental picture fell apart. I was too nervous to bring up the play, as I had planned. In fact, I would probably still be standing there now if she had not mentioned the play herself. Even then, I could not find the courage to ask her for a date as she rambled on about how good it was supposed to be. When I finally tried to ask her, nonchalantly, if she would like to accompany me, I was betrayed by one of the most embarrassing elements of a growing boy. My voice, instead of sounding manly and powerful, squealed as a result of my nervousness. My face promptly turned red instead of the pale color I'm certain it had been throughout our conversation as a result of my nervousness. It was during this transformation of color that Judy informed me she would be glad to go to the play with me. Then she hurried off to her class. I lingered in the hall long enough to allow some of the red to leave my face. As a result, I was late for my English class. The instructor, noticing my late arrival, asked loudly if something was wrong with my leg. This made me realize that my attempt to blend in with the wall had resulted in my walking strangely. This is what prompted my teacher's remark. The next day seemed to drag on as my nervousness mounted until it reached the point where I felt like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. I had told Judy that I would pick her up at 7 o'clock. So, at 6:30, I was dressed and ready to go. Anywhere except on my first date. I must have looked like a clown. First of all, the hair on the back of my head insisted on going everywhere except where I wanted it to go. My shoes were old and worn, and my attempts to hide that fact under shoe polish had been anything but successful. Added to that,
I was growing rather fast at the time, so my clothes didn't fit very well. To avoid looking like the Jolly Green Giant, I borrowed my father's sport coat, which was only slightly too large. Unfortunately, I could not hide the length of my pants. If short, tight pants had been the style then, instead of 2 years later, I would have felt much more comfortable. At Judy's home, I climbed the steps to the front door and promptly tripped over something and tumbled to my knees in the snow. When her father answered the doorbell, I knew he must have witnessed the event when he said he hoped I had not hurt myself. I hastily replied that I must have caught my shoelaces on something. He left the room smiling, and I then realized that in my haste to hide my clumsiness, I had forgotten that I was wearing loafers. Arriving at the school in time to find good seats, Judy and I did enjoy the play, although it was difficult for me to concentrate on it, with the scent of her perfume wafting my way throughout the entire production. When the play ended, we made our way to the drugstore for sodas while we waited for my father to come pick us up. Although I attempted to be the perfect gentleman and experienced romancer, I somehow managed to bump Judy's glass. The result was that soda and I splashed and tinkled to the floor. We both managed to avoid being hit by the fluid, but it was enough to shatter what little confidence I had built up. Finally, arriving home, I was convinced that I could enter casually and make my family think the date had gone fine, and I was now well on my way to being a real Don Juan. But once again, fate took over. As I entered the house smiling and happy, I tripped again and fell flat on my face. This was A Forgettable First Date by Stephen C. Olson. In the time that's remaining, I'd like to wish all of you a happy, healthy Valentine's Day with the one you love. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.